Bereshit 47. Then Yosef went in and told Pharaoh, "My father and brothers have come from the land of Canaan with their flocks, livestock, and all their possessions. Right now they are in the land of Goshen." He took five of his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" They answered Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and our ancestors," and added, "We have come to live in the land, because in the land of Canaan there is no place to pasture your servants' flocks. The famine is so severe there. Therefore, please, let your servants live in the land of Goshen." Pharaoh said to Yosef, "Your father and brothers have come to you, and the land of Egypt lies before you. Have your father and brothers live on the best property in the country. Let them live in the land of Goshen. Moreover, if you know that some of them are particularly competent, put them in charge of my livestock." Yosef then brought in Yaakov, his father, and presented him to Pharaoh. And Yaakov blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh asked Yaakov, "How old are you?" And Yaakov replied, "The time of my stay on earth has been 130 years. They have been few and difficult, fewer than the years my ancestors lived." Then Yaakov blessed Pharaoh and left his presence. Yosef found a place for his father and brothers and gave them property in the land of Egypt, in the best region of the country, in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had ordered. Yosef provided food for his father, his brothers, and all his father's household, taking full care of even the youngest. There was no food anywhere, for the famine was very severe, so that both Egypt and Canaan grew weak from hunger. Yosef collected all the money there was in Egypt and Canaan in exchange for the grain they bought, and put the money in Pharaoh's treasury. When all the money in Egypt had been spent, and likewise in Canaan, all the Egyptians approached Yosef and said, "Give us something to eat, even though we have no money. Why should we die before your eyes?" Yosef replied, "Give me your livestock. If you don't have money, I will give you food in exchange for your livestock." So they brought Yosef their livestock, and Yosef gave them food in exchange for the horses, flocks, cattle, and donkeys. All that year he provided them with food in exchange for all their livestock. When that year was over, they approached Yosef again and said to him, "We won't hide from my lord that all our money is spent, and the herds of livestock belong to my lord. We have nothing left, as my lord can see, but our bodies and our land. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we and our land will be enslaved to Pharaoh. But also give us seed to plant, so that we can stay alive and not die, and so that the land won't become barren." So Yosef acquired all the land in Egypt for Pharaoh, as one by one the Egyptians sold their fields, because the famine weighed on them so severely. Thus the land became the property of Pharaoh. As for the people, he reduced them to serfdom city by city, from one end of Egypt's territory to the other. Only the priest's land did he not acquire, because the priests were entitled to provisions from Pharaoh, and they ate from what Pharaoh provided them. Therefore they did not sell their land. Then Yosef said to the people, "As of today I have acquired you and your land for Pharaoh. Here is seed for you to sow the land. When harvest time comes, you are to give 20% to Pharaoh. 80% will be yours to keep for seed to plant in the fields, as well as for your food and for that of your households and your little ones." They replied, "You saved our lives. So if it pleases my lord, we will be Pharaoh's slaves." Yosef made it a law for the country of Egypt, valid to this day, that Pharaoh should have 20%. Only the property belonging to the priests did not become Pharaoh's. Israel lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. They acquired possessions in it and were productive, and their numbers multiplied greatly. Yaakov lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. Thus Yaakov lived to be 147 years old. The time came when Israel was approaching death. So he called for his son Yosef and said to him, "If you truly love me, please put your hand under my thigh and pledge that, out of consideration for me, you will not bury me in Egypt. Rather, when I sleep with my fathers, you are to carry me out of Egypt and bury me where they are buried." He replied, "I will do as you have said." He said, "Swear it to me." And he swore to him. Then Israel bowed down at the head of his bed. 48. A while later, someone told Yosef that his father was ill. He took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Yaakov was told, "Here comes your son Yosef." Israel gathered his strength and sat up in bed. Yaakov said to Yosef, "El Shaddai appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me, saying to me, 'I will make you fruitful and numerous. I will make of you a group of peoples, and I will give this land to your descendants to possess forever.' Now your two sons, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh will be as much mine as Reuben and Simeon are. The children born to you after them will be yours, but for purposes of inheritance, they are to be counted with their older brothers. Now as for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel died suddenly, as we were traveling through the land of Canaan, while we were still some distance from Ephrat. So I buried her there on the way to Ephrat, also known as Bethlehem. Then Israel noticed Yosef's sons and asked, "Whose are these?" Yosef answered his father, "They are my sons, whom God has given me here." Yaakov replied, "I want you to bring them here to me so that I can bless them." Now Israel's eyes were dim with age, so that he could not see. Yosef brought his sons near to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. Israel said to Yosef, "I never expected to see even you again, but God has allowed me to see your children too." Yosef brought them out from between his legs and prostrated himself on the ground. Then Yosef took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near to him. But Israel put out his hand and laid it on the head of the younger one, Ephraim, and put his left hand on the head of Manasseh. He intentionally crossed his hands, even though Manasseh was the firstborn. Then he blessed Yosef. "The God in whose presence my fathers, Abraham and Yitzhak, lived, the God who has been my own shepherd all my life long to this day, the angel who has rescued me from all harm, bless these boys. May they remember who I am and what I stand for, and likewise my fathers, Abraham and Yitzhak, who they were and what they stood for. And may they grow into teeming multitudes on the earth." When Yosef saw that his father was laying his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him. And he lifted up his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head and place it instead on Manasseh's head. Yosef said to his father, "Don't do it that way, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know that, my son, I know it. He too will become a people, and he too will be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother will be greater than he, and his descendants will grow into many nations." Then he added this blessing on them that day. Israel will speak of you in their own blessings by saying, "May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh." Thus he put Ephraim ahead of Manasseh. Israel then said to Joseph, "You see that I am dying, but God will be with you and will bring you back to the land of your ancestors. Moreover, I am giving to you Shechem more than to your brothers. I captured it from the Amorites with my sword and bow."
Any thoughts? A lot. He's got to get a little microphone out there first.
One of the most intriguing things is that Yaakov actually adopted Joseph's sons as his own. So that's an interesting thing, I think.
Right. Get to that a little bit.
I have a couple questions. Is there a significance in the number 147 for Jacob's years, how old he was? And the other one was, how did Jacob know that they were going, that the second born was going to be, greater? How did he know that? Or was he just making a prophetic, saying this is what's going to happen because of the words coming
okay.
out of his mouth, you know?
I'm glad you questioned it up because I'll go talk about that even if a question didn't come up. All right. You have another statement, question? One thing, all due respect to many of the translations that are out there, they are worded quite differently. And when he read it, it kind of worded differently than what it is written there in Hebrew. And sometimes people interpret that it means this in modern translations, but it doesn't really mean that in the Hebrew. So we're going to go through a few of those things. And each one of you have a different kind of translations. Most of you do. I'm an old man. And guess what translation I use? King James. I know all the flaws and mistakes and everything else in King James. And I don't want to go through and research all the flaws and mistakes in any of the other translations, including the complete Jewish translation of the Bible. I find a lot of them there. When I have one, I find, oops. There's too many mistakes, so I'm not worried about it. And, of course, the American Revised is not too bad. And the Jewish Publication Society has sometimes their own interpretation within it, too. And they kind of ignore what it says in Hebrew. So I'm not a great Hebrew scholar. I just check on words. I listen to words, I pay attention to words. What on earth did that come from? So that's my open statement here today. Because it's interesting how when he read this in that translation, that I couldn't find, I've never heard that translated. In all due respect, I don't say you should not have one. I'm saying, just keep in mind that lots of times when you have a new translation, it really is trying to modernize it into our modern English. And our English is a living language. And since it's a living language, the definitions change rapidly from one generation to the next. In fact, this generation probably has, 14,000 different definitions of some of the basic basic English words from its beginning. So I'm kind of in a 1611 world. It's kind of a dead language in a sense. Okay, so the fascinating things that I would like to be able to talk about, he said five of his brothers, very fascinating who the five were. But it doesn't tell us who the five were. I assume they're probably the sons of what mother? Leah. I would assume it would be Leah because they were the contentions. Why? I always had this fighting between the two families constantly. Right? The two mothers were always at each other's throat. And the name, and we went through the process of the naming of all their sons. And they did it in retaliation toward the other woman for having their sons. and the definitions were very, very fascinating to look at and know. But now they're grown men, and Joseph more than likely would not have had Benjamin there. I don't see any sense why he would have Bilhah's children there either, but more than likely would have been Leah's, because in this particular area, we're going to, two of the names of the brothers show up. So kind of interesting to know. That's just my thinking. Doesn't mean anything. But anyway, verse.
I know the older ones were, but were all the other brothers shepherds as well?
Yeah, the whole family was shepherds. That's what they did for a living. They weren't plowmen. They weren't out there agricultural, growing grass and growing wheat. They were actually, their main trade effect was that. Whatever cattle or were basically sheep and goats, two main things that they actually did their most of the harvesting. Or not harvesting, I mean they were raising up with. That's why they had to be called shepherds, or they were called herdsmen. They're not known for their ability, not known for their ability. They're not known, in biblically speaking, for growing crops. Unlike Egypt, was known for growing crops and not known for the purpose of raising cattle or sheep or goats. Does that kind of answer your question? Yeah. Verse 6, Genesis 47, verse 6. Here Pharaoh spoke unto Joseph, saying, thy father and thy brothers are come unto thee. The land of Egypt, therefore, is before you. In the best of the land make thy father and brother to dwell. That's the land of Goshen. Remember what I told you what Goshen meant? The land that can be plowed. All right. Now, they, different kind of, they weren't plowing the land for the purpose of growing corn, wheat, and barley. They had to do it for different reasons. We'll get to there in a minute. Because we'll explain as we, I mean, it explains itself as we keep on going. When one looks at this event, and one must have to wonder, how bad was the famine? Now, we're in the beginning of the third year at this particular point. This book goes back again, this chapter goes back to the beginning of the famine and tells what took place, how Joseph instituted certain things, but before the Israelites, or actually the Israelites, Jacob and his sons came down. And so we look at this thing, and the fascinating thing is that this famine, you find on this chapter, this famine affected two major countries. Now, it didn't affect any other except maybe those two major countries. And it was the land of what? And the land of Egypt. Not the land of Goshen. It was, but not technically. We'll get to there. The book starts explaining why. Who really owned the land of Goshen? All right. Now, this is not a happenstance. We have eternal creator of heaven and earth. What does he do? He's in charge of everything, right? So he is going to make sure he takes care of what he had promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the very beginning. He's going to take care of his family. And the Egyptians were not being taken care of. There was a certain section of Egyptians were. We'll get to there in a minute. We find out, it says, okay, so he is bringing about, you know, they live in the land of Goshen, where it's one of the major, we'll call it mouths, I guess, of the Nile River, heading northeast. That one, the land remained plush and green. Even to this day, it's the best land of all of Egypt, that area. Same area that they could grow things. Now, in verse 49, which he read, was a pretty good translation, and some of you maybe have a different translation, we talked about where it says here, he asked him how old he was, and then he says he was 130 years, he was a pilgrim. Pilgrims, by the way, pilgrimage is a phrase in Hebrew, which means what? Sojourning on this earth. Now, see, that was very well taught to whom? Whom? Well, before that. Abraham. What does it say about it? He sojourned on the earth. He never actually ever lived in the land that was going to be promised to him. It never was given to him. And it was never given to Isaac. And it was never given to Jacob. We'll get to this point here because of a promise that God said, which Jacob records and repeats. All right? Go down here. And he says now, few and evil are the days, some of your translations have that, of the years of my life. Now, when I explained what evil was before, and that translation actually got it pretty good. It was troublesome. Bad times. See, his life was few in comparison to the life of Abraham and the life of Isaac. They lived a lot longer. At this particular point in time, Jacob knew that his life was less than the other two. That is, the other two fathers, Abraham and Isaac. But his days were bad. Now, why would he say this to Pharaoh? Why would he register his days were bad? Let me ask you a question. Have any of you ever had some hard trials and hard difficulties that seemed to last for a long time? What, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 10 years? How long did it last for Jacob? Almost from the very beginning of his life, especially when he had to go into Laban. Trouble, chaos, trouble, chaos, trouble, chaos. His sons did something that he was troublesome and chaos to him. He moved, traveled back and forth. His own brother was out to kill him. Because he didn't live a life of luxury, of freedom, of enjoyment, of a wonderful time, of joy of life. He did not have in his life, when you just study and read his life, it was not full of joy and happiness. It was not full of great abundance of, wow, look what the Lord had done for me. It was, look what's happened to me. And for all those years, he thought for sure his son was dead, which he loved the most. And he was always terrified of Benjamin's life, wasn't he? Remember he said, I don't want Benjamin to go down with you, to the brothers, because harm will come unto him. Because why? Constant feud was going on from the sons of Leah and the sons of Rachel. And the sons of Rachel were losing, weren't they? Real bad. They hated Joseph at the very beginning, and when Joseph had his dreams, they even hated him all the more. To the point where, you know, they wanted to kill him. And then one of them said, well, why don't we just sell him, make some money on this guy. And we know the story from there, not to go on to that point. So we see here that, you know, sometime when we think we're in sorrow in our life, we live in a horrible world, or we have nothing but pain and suffering, sometimes we bring it upon ourselves. Let's say our healing, our sickness is brought upon ourselves. Now, he didn't say he was sick. He just says his life was horrible, troublesome, a difficult life. Talk about somebody endures. He endured all the way to the end of his life. Yes.
I think it started out with two wives.
Two what?
Two wives.
Yes.
Trouble.
Trouble. Especially when they're sisters on top of all that. Right. I'm not arguing at all on this situation. Not a single thing in me. But see, God does not alter some of our sins and transgressions or stupidity. Sometimes I think God has just to deal with the stupidity we do and says, okay, I love you. I'm going to have to do with it. Or how am I going to alter this thing for you? And because he made a promise to Abraham. Long before, and Abraham had his troubles, but nothing like Jacob did. Okay. I want to make that one kind of a little bit clearer on that point. Now, another thing about blessing. He blessed Jacob came up and he blessed Pharaoh. Now, some people I have read assume that he blessed him in the relationship that people use the name to bless. There's nothing there that says it's the name. And so he would not have used HaShemayim. He would not have used HaElohim. And he would not have used, because he didn't know the name of Yahweh or Yahuwah. He didn't know that name. He knew the name of El Shaddai, He didn't bless him. Do you think he blessed him in the name of El Shaddai? What does El Shaddai mean? The one that destroyer. The one that deluges things. The one that wipes out all mankind. And that's how he got his name. And he told Abraham, that's who I am. My name is Shaddai. I'm the one that does the destruction. So how would you like to be blessed by someone who does destruction? You know, God, may the destroyer bless you. That doesn't sound very good blessing, does it? May the one that wiped out all mankind on the face of the earth, may he bless you. Wow, that's pretty powerful, right? But on the other hand, because it's a society, back in those days, it's not much different than ours. When you greet somebody, do you greet them with the curse or do you greet them with the blessing? How do you bless them? Good morning, how are you? Is that a curse or is it a blessing? The blessing. Good day. Is that a cursing or blessing? Good evening. Is that a cursing or blessing? Now, I know there are people who say, blankety blank with you. Well, that's a curse, right? So be careful. Use this, overusing this word of blessing does not mean what we think it means in the complete picture, because it has to do with what does blessing mean? You get down, you have something you kneel with, okay? You give a tribute to. And his translation there showed, we'll get to there in a minute, that Joseph, when he went to his father, they had him prostrate himself on the ground. I went through this many, many times before, and once again, that's not the translation. We'll get to there, we'll get the point. Because he didn't prostrate himself to the ground. The Hebrew is very fascinating what word he used, and we'll find it when we get there. But keep things in mind that when you have your translations, and this is my point here, just check it out. Find out what it really says in the Hebrew language. You may get it right and you may get it wrong. Sometimes I get a lot of things wrong. Believe it or not. But my desire is to keep searching. And I am, you know, accepted the mere fact that what the angel said unto Jacob, you don't need to know my name. It's none of your business. The end. Okay, accept that. And we see it here at the end of the last chapter. He says, that angel, that Melech, that was with me, he doesn't know his name, doesn't matter. Okay? Obviously, he would have had a man, quote, a principality, in a quote, one that carries out. As I said before, what does an angel do? He carries out the word. He carries out Devarim Elohim. Whatever God says, they institute. They're not a bunch of nice guys up there with a bunch of cupid little things to shoot and say, oh, what a wonderful person. No, they carry out the word of the Lord. And every time they carry out the word of the Lord, most of the time, we read the prophets, is really bad news. Once in a great while, an angel will come forth, like he did to Mary, and gave good news to her. But also gave good news to Zechariah, right? And what does Zechariah do? I doubt you. What did the angel do? Silenced him right there in the spot. Oh, you know, that's pretty powerful. Good thing he didn't kill him. You know, we know that. We don't go into those things. But the word angel is a messenger, that not just a messenger of the words, messenger with actions and deeds and carries out. I want to keep that very clear. I will always say this, repeat this many times, because sometimes we get into this thing of being an angel is a nice, wonderful thing. And during this particular time of year, what big movie is going to be back on the screen again? That you see year after year after year after year after year. Yeah, right. Wonderful life. And someone turns into an angel. Wait a minute. Let's talk about truth, what the biblical word angel is about. A messenger of Devarim Elohim. Messenger of the word of God. The words of God come from him. Actions come from him. Whenever God speaks, action must follow. He's not speaking worthlessly. He doesn't speak with stupidity words, with nothing else to say, but when he opens his mouth, you better institute what he just said, right? If you don't, someone else is going to institute something about you. You don't want that to happen, right? I picture God very powerful, merciful, kind, yes. Powerful, more so. All right, so This is my input here. You don't have to really accept it, but I just want to tell you that. Now, verse 11, it says, "And Joseph placed his father and his brethren and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best land, the land of Ramses." We'll get to that definition of that word much later in the book of Exodus. What it means. I'm not going to tell you what it refers to now. But just to understand, Ramses was where? Land of Goshen. Keep that part in mind. It's in the land of Goshen that it was at. All right? It wasn't somewhere like some people put him way down south near Cairo. No, way up north in the plush land, the best land of all. And he said, now, verse 12, that Joseph nourished his father and his brethren. What that means in basically simple English is, Joseph did not take anything from his father or his brother. He, Joseph, provided for all of them. Well, second command, right? Second command, second commander. We know this about Joseph. How many times was he second command? Three times. Right? First time was? Potiphar. Second time was? In the prison. Third time was? Pharaoh. Never in command, second one in the command. All right? Very important to keep that parallel in mind. All right. You might very bad. You got a question?
I had a comment. When he blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, the scripture says, and he blessed Joseph.
Right, we'll
and
get
said,
there. We'll get there.
So,
you have the next chapter, though.
Well, I know, but it makes sense that he would provide for his father's household because he basically took the place as the firstborn son through his sons.
Okay, I see. He took the place of a savior. That's what he took the place of. Remember, what is his name in Hebrew? I mean, in Greek? Egyptian? What does it mean?
Concealed, revealed.
That which is concealed, he reveals. That's what his name is in Egypt. And guess why? Why was that so? Because of the dreams, right? Oh, he wasn't mean that it is that Joseph understood or God revealed unto Joseph the hidden things and then Joseph revealed them unto Pharaoh or to anybody else. So he, in a sense, is a revealer. He's also called the Savior. And the Egyptian said, "You have saved us." All right, from dying. Now, who do we associate with Savior as? Yeah, sure. So we have a parallel here, a picture of something that's going to take place much deeper in the future. Now, when the Messiah comes, is he going to do more than just save your soul? We think it's all he's going to do here to save our soul. Forget about anything else. No, he says, "I came that you may have life and life more what? Abundantly." Going to provide for you. Sometimes we get this wonderful paycheck, we work like hard with it, we sweat and swore. We think, "Oh, look what I've earned." Now you got to learn, he says, "No, look what the Eternal has given unto me." Because he could take away your job just as fast as he gave it. So all blessings go unto him, the Eternal, greater heaven and earth. Okay, let's go on. Man, do my very best here. Anyway, verse 13, "And there was no bread in that land, for the famine was sore in the land of Egypt and all land of Canaan." They fainted away or disappeared. They lost the reason. They had no more money, no more land, nor crops. Anyway, and I want to go down now to verse 14. "And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Canaan and the land of Egypt for the corn which they brought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And when the money failed or ceased in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, the Egyptians came to Pharaoh," not the Canaanites. give us bread, for why should we die in thy presence? For the money has failed. The economy collapsed. Does that sound like it may happen here in our country? Or maybe it's already happened here in our country. The economy has collapsed. Not collapsing, it's collapsed already. It's not going to return back the way it was. I mean, there's no way it's going to return back. Everybody knows that. So after you gather all the money, it's very interesting here in Hebrew as well as in Hebrew, English. This occurred in the first year of the 7 years of famine. The next statement says, and verse 18, of course, he took away the crops. He took away took away the flocks, the herds, and so forth. Verse 18, and that year was ended. They came unto him the second year. Now remember, Jacob has not yet been down there. His family not been down there yet. So find out what Joseph did to the land of Egypt. And the second year, what happened? Second year of the famine, of the seven-year famine. He took away something. They came unto him, and they said, we will not hide from my Lord, for now that our money is spent, and our Lord has all our herd, our cattle, and so on and so forth, there is nothing left but our bodies and our land. Verse 19, therefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land. Buy us and our land for bread or for food, and our land we will be service unto Pharaoh, and give seed to us that we may not die, and the land not be desolate. Now already, this is the second year has passed, or since it's beginning of the second year. Now all of a sudden now, all the money is now gone. And all the cattle, all the herds, all the sheep, and everything else they had is now in the ownership of Pharaoh. Second year comes, and they say, okay, take away now. He will buy us. We'll become servants and slaves unto Pharaoh. Prior to that, were they landowners? Did they have their own business? Were they independent of Pharaoh? Were they businessmen? Were they free individuals? Yeah, they were. Along comes Joseph and does a maneuver that puts them into bondage. Now, we may disagree with him on this issue, but that's what he did, right? Okay. We'll talk about this a little bit later on. I'm not going to be able to reach this thing. Of course, we know that they call it 20%. It's 1 in 5 went to Pharaoh. Yes.
I just have a question concerning, you said it was the very first year of the 7 years of famine. But the brothers had come. I mean, when the brothers came, there was already the famine was being felt.
The second year, right? But in the writings of the book of Genesis, that is written differently than any other book. We have now, up to that point, what happened, and we'll get to there in a minute.
Uh-huh.
What happened to the family of Joseph? But what happened to the family of Egypt? What happened to the family of Canaan? And we're going back in time. What took place? And it says in Hebrew, in the second year they came to him, that is, Egyptians said what? Joseph did not come down there until the beginning of the third year.
Right.
Because at the beginning of the third year, he came
Jacob
in there.
Came.
Jacob
okay.
came because it has to do with the feast of...
Okay, so this is...
What feast does it have to do with? Passover. We'll get to there.
Okay.
And we'll get to there.
Okay.
That's not totally down the future. So you know in the third year, beginning of the third year, Joseph was approximately, was my guessing,
so this
either
is
39 or 40 when he saw his father for the first time.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
You see what I'm saying so far? Not a chronological... The Bible doesn't write in chronological order. They write in events, in events, in events. We'll see that more heavier in the book of Numbers, where we see event, in event, in event. Okay. Have no relationship to what took place at the time of Moses. It took place many years later in the book of Judges.
Right. Okay.
But they're listed there in Numbers for a reason. It has a pattern. That's how God teaches us, by the way. I'm going to show you this. We, because we're human beings, want in chronological order. God says, no, I'm telling you, this means that. See, this means the same thing as that. That over there means the same thing. God speaks in groups, in parallels, in patterns. I'll use that word. That's how God thinks. Because see, time is not in His world. He created the time, but it's not in His world. Events are in His world. Okay? The seventh day is an event in His world, not a created thing in His world. It's an event that took place. Every one of the first day, second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day were events. What were the events about? What Devarim Elohim said and happened. This event took place first day. This event took place second day. We kind of put it our time cycle. But in reality, we're talking about what God did. When He opened His mouth, action took place. All right. Now, we'll keep on going here. I don't know if I get the next chapter or not. Let's move. Verse 22. Very important now. Only the land of the priest bought he, Joseph, not. For the priest had a portion assigned them by Pharaoh and did eat their own portion that Pharaoh assigned to them. Therefore, they sold not their lands. So now we have a section of the Egyptians who did not have to sell their land. What was the section? Who were they? They were the priests. Now, it's a fascinating picture, isn't it? Do you think that God did something here?
Wasn't Joseph over the priests? I thought we discussed that last week.
Okay. How did he get over them?
By revealing while they couldn't.
No, Pharaoh told him he's got the power over them. Pharaoh has power over the priesthood. That's why he gave a portion to them. Okay, the leadership always will have power over the priesthood. Even during the time of David, who had the power of the priesthood? David, the king. All right, we know that. Daniel's going through this quite a bit. We've got detail. They're not independent on their own and say they can do what they want to do. They have to answer to their Lord and their master. Let's get back here. And so we know that. Now, who was Joseph's father-in-law? The priest of On. All right. So God, in a sense, put it this way, in order to whom God... Now, Joseph is connected to the priest of On. He's connected to them. And all the priests of On, all the priests of that area, which is the land of Goshen, by the way, On is in the land of Goshen, they did not have to give up anything, because they related now to Joseph. All right? You got that? Very fast, they didn't know that. Okay. In verse 29, I want to clarify this, because in his translation is really weird. I'm sorry about this. In verse 29, chapter 49, and in Hebrew it says, this is Israel or the father, Jacob, saying something to Joseph. And he says, time drew near and high that Israel must die. And he called his son Joseph, and he said unto him, if now I have found grace in your sight. Now he translated, if you love me. No stipulation on that one. If you love me, I have found grace. Now what does grace mean? Favor. Simple as that. Now, here the father is asking, saying unto Joseph, if I have found favor, if you have favored me, would you do this? And that had, of course, to do. And verse 31, where am I at now? Okay, 31. Well, that's not where I want to go. Put my prayer under thy thigh and deal kindly with thy and truly with me. Bury me not in the land of Egypt. So he said, yes, I will. And of course, he had to make a swear, an oath. And that oath had to be Israel bowed, not worshipped, bowed himself toward the bed's end or into the bed, head of the bed. 48. Got to get you real quick. Yes.
I was just wondering if you could expound on that hand under the thigh. Is that just how to make a covenant, or I just I'm a little distant
all right.
from that?
Technically means he put his hand on his private parts. That's how they made an oath. How man made an oath to man.
Really?
They don't translate that quite nicely in English because it doesn't really fit in English. Thigh. No, that's not it, you know. No, that's not. It's not under. He's not laying down. It's really grabbing hold of something that's very personal, very private. This is between two men and two men doing something that they must do. It's weird. Weird. Our society, we call that creepy, right? Hey, we call it creepy, weird. But you know, you ask me the question. That's what it is. Okay. Don't go any farther with that. You may disagree with it, but that's how it was. Doesn't mean that God said to do this. All right? This is what Abraham required of his servant, and this is what Israel is requiring of his son. You can't back down from that one.
What?
Can't back down from that one. It was not an oath unto God. It was not an oath unto Elohim. Elohim was not an oath unto El Shaddai. It was between the two men. That's how powerful that thing. We in the world, we say, it's weird. Yes?
Is that where testimony and testify come from? Well, don't those have the same issue is a statement of fact or a promise or a covenant? It is a testimony.
Yes, testimony.
Or you testify.
Yes.
That's true.
Okay, let's get to chapter 48. I want to try if I can get to 48 as quick as possible. I think it's bad 48 because I want to go into 48 and 49 are kind of connected together. Actually, 47, 48, and 49 are all connected, including the 50th chapter. We're not getting there yet. I'm trying to run as fast as I can because I think it's very important. I sometimes waste too much time. But I want to say something here. And it came to pass in the first verse in 48. And it came to pass of these things that after the situation took place about the event of making an oath, that once again, his father was sick, and of course at the point of death. And he took, Joseph took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, and one told Jacob and said, "Behold, your son comes." And he says now, he says, one of them says, look here, who's the one? One of the brothers called Joseph, went to Joseph and told him, your father's dying. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? It wasn't just a fellow guy, it was one of the brothers. It probably was Judah. That's my personal thinking. Personal thinking only. Judah's quite involved in a lot of this stuff here, but it doesn't mention his name here, but just my personal thinking. Now behold, Jacob says something to Joseph. Elohim, or El Shaddai, appeared unto me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. How did he bless him? Listen. Behold, I will make thee fruitful and multiply thee. And I will make thee a multitude of people. And I will give this land to thy seed after thee for an everlasting possession. How many promises are there? There's at least three. Remember, magic number, three. The first promise, he says, I will make thee fruitful and multiply. Okay, we got that, you know, seven sons, 12 sons, lots of grandkids. Now, the next statement says, and I will make thee a multitude of people. Oh, so that's bigger than it was before, right? Right now, there are how many Israelites are down there? 70. Might have had a kid, children or two. Who knows what? In those 7 years later, or 17 years later. But nonetheless, and the third one was, I will give this land, meaning the Canaan, to thy seed after and for everlasting possession. Now, here we have Jacob telling Joseph, what Elohim promised him. That Joseph would fruitful and be multiplied, the multitude of people will come from Jacob, and the land of Canaan will be given to Jacob's seed after he dies. See, Jacob never received the land. Remember I said that before? He never received the land. He never received the promise. Only way down the future, we'll talk about that much later, was it ever given to them. Now he turns around and he says, of course, he blesses Ephraim and Manasseh. He wants them as the other firstborn, like, you know, firstborn was Reuben, secondborn was Simeon. And that's what he says they'll take into, and they are now mine, be part of me, part of my family. In verse 8, and Israel, now the name changes. It's very, very important when it comes from Jacob, then all of a sudden now, Israel's talking. Remember Daniel went through the name of Jonathan? And sometimes it says a different word, not Jonathan. Same thing here in relationship. When you have, it says Israel speaking, now we're going to run into something more significant. It has to do directly relationship to God, because God says you will no longer be called this, you'll be called that. But he kept on calling Jacob, many times Jacob, Jacob, Jacob. And very seldom ever called him Israel. Because Israel had to be something entirely different. We won't go into that today. And so Israel beheld Jacob's sons. And this is, who are these? Joseph said to his father, they are my sons in whom Elohim has given me in this place. Verse 10. It said, now the eyes of Israel were dim from age. I find that very fascinating. That he could not see. And Jacob and he, Joseph, brought them near unto him. And he kissed them. That is, Jacob kissed them. Israel kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said unto Jacob, I have not thought that I would ever see your face. And now Elohim has allowed me to even see your seed. And his translation is a little better. Some of your translations of the next verse is that Jacob brought them out from between his knees. That's not a really poor translation. If you've got that in your translation, it's not between. It's really bad translation. It should be before his knees. He had in front of him, you know, a given friggin' prince. Fascinating to think about what's taking place here. How old do you think Ephraim and Manasseh were? Okay, backtrack. Let's put ourselves in perspective here now. Ephraim and Manasseh were in their at least 20s. Now get the picture. They were born before, right? And there was then, Jacob didn't die until 17 years later. So, it depends upon the birth of, I know, of Manasseh. Was he born on the first year that he married, that Jacob got married, or Joseph got married? Or maybe the second year he had a son, the third year. Or maybe pushed it far back, he finally had a son at the, you know, eighth year. And maybe Ephraim, you know, babies, you know, maybe they were born babies. But even 17 years later, the best that you could come up with is that they were at least between the age of either 27 to 28, or at least Manasseh was between 27 to 28, at the high end, and at the low end, might have been about, you know, 19 years old. So we've got 17 years going by. He's not sitting them on his knee. They're not little kids. They're not babies. They're grown men who probably, by this time, maybe, do not know, have a wife and have children. Doesn't say that. But when they came out of Egypt, of course, they had a lot more. But just keep this in mind. And so I said, the picture sometimes we have in our world, because, see, we don't relate to what's going on, and we think these are grown babies to maybe 1 or 2 years old. Oh, they're not. They're grown men. Way up there. At the youngest, I calculated, at the possible youngest. All right? It's kind of weird. So they had to be probably in their 20s. More than likely, they're probably in their 30s. But I can't say that. But it doesn't say that. Well, not 30, but they've been pretty close to 30. And anyway, he says, now, Joseph took Ephraim. Very fascinating now. Joseph took Ephraim, who was on his right-hand side. Joseph, right-hand side. Right? And, but he was facing Israel's, of course, left-hand side. And Manasseh is on his left-hand side, which was Israel's right-hand side. And, of course, what did Joseph do? Just cross them over. Who crossed over first? Joseph did the crossing over of the hands, and it was rejected. There along comes Joseph, and he changed the directions. Now, it's very funny. He couldn't see, right? Israel's dim. Unable to tell who was who. Who are these? Grown men? Who are these? Now, more than likely, they would kneel down before him out of honor and respect. I mean, they would have run on their knees probably before him because he's the patriarch. Right? And Joseph was, Israel was probably on his bed, unable to really rise and stand up, ready to die. And it says here, interesting that Joseph did this. And Israel, says verse 8, stretched out his hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was a younger, and his left hand upon Manasseh's head. Now, so how blind was Israel? He saw, what did he see? He saw them exchange. Well, I don't know, the exchange can't be that way. It's got to be the other way. So he reversed the whole exchange. And he say, now, why? What was it that Israel was seeing? What was it that Israel was doing? You remember the promise? Why would he do that? Because he just likes Ephraim over Manasseh? Kelly.
It was probably because God told him ahead, now this is how I want you to bless him, and this is how you do it.
Now, we think it's all the actions of one man. Listen, what is written in the book of Genesis is not the actions of one man. It's the actions of Elohim. It's the actions of the creator of heaven and earth. Everything took place by his power, by his will, by his desire, by his plan. We may not like it, that's our problem. We may disagree with it. That's not his problem. It's our problem, right? Yes.
He was also the second born that got the blessing.
He was what?
He was the second born of him and his brother.
Right.
And he got the blessing.
Right. But why would he call, why would he give Ephraim the blessing?
Well, he
didn't
like the name of
that. All right. But anyway, because of that, incident took place. Now they ask the blessings of the sons. How they ask the blessings of the sons? As Ephraim and Manasseh. It's right here in the book of Genesis. From that point on, the blessing was from, as blessed the children, then as Ephraim and Manasseh. All right, now remember the blessing was. All right, now that's the end of this chapter now. Any questions real quick? Yes.
To be a theme. Because Isaac was the second born. Jacob was the second born. And I heard even Abraham was the second born.
And at the same time, who's making the choice? The creator of heaven and earth is making the choice. We think it's somebody else. It's not him. It's not somebody else. It's him. The whole book of Genesis tells you where it began. Who was in the beginning? Elohim. Does he start a pattern? Of course he starts a pattern. Does he have a purpose? Did his purpose crash? Did his purpose go into chaos? And he didn't know what to do? You can't pick. He puts his plan in. See, even if you make a mistake, you err, guess what? I'm going to take the other one. He does. He's going to carry out his will. And that's important. Last verse I have to clarify because I don't have an answer to it. But at the same time, because it's written, I have to believe it so. He says, moreover, this is Israel saying, moreover, I have given thee one portion above thy brethren. What is that one portion? One portion, not twice. Just one portion. And which I took from the hand of Amorite. Remember, Amorite was the ally of Abraham when they went to war. Last verse, 22. Remember Amorite? He was the one that went to war with Abraham, and he was his ally. Now, we see here that Jacob says something. But I took it from the hands with my sword, with my bow. You can't find that written anywhere. However, because it's written here, even though the Genesis didn't even show that Jacob ever went to war, I kind of believe he must have had done so, even though it's not written. Don't take it. I've heard in commentaries that he didn't go to war, so it must be a phony thing. I disagree. It's written here, so I feel. That's my side comment, by the way. Nothing really important. Yes.
Could this be Jacob taking responsibility for the war that Simeon and Levi actually started against, in a sense, started against the family of Shechem in the incident with Dinah?
Right.
They started a war, in a sense, with that family.
Well, he is responsible.
And so
I grant
he, in a sense, he's
it.
Taking responsibility from it, even though it wasn't his fault or anything like that. He's the father, he's the patriarch, it's still his war.
But Shechem was not of the family of Amorite. Amorite was down for south and east from where Shechem is. South and west, I'm sorry, where Shechem was. Any more questions? Keep in mind, fascinating thing about when the land of promise, who got double portion of land? Was it Ephraim or was it Manasseh? Manasseh got double portion of land. Whoops! What happened here? Go ahead.
Why did Yaakov feel he had to adopt Ephraim and Manasseh?
Because of the name. The name of Ephraim and the name of Manasseh. One that forgot and the one that's fruitful. And so you're bringing back what to Jacob's mind? I am not forgotten. I didn't forget and you didn't forget me, even though with no connection.
Would it have anything to do with his wife being not a Hebrew?
No.
And the Jewish bloodline going through the mother?
No. That don't be. Because when you look at the sons of Jacob, who they marry? They couldn't marry except the Canaanites or anybody else that was in that land. And they had children from that point on. So the family line does come through, biblically speaking, the father, the male. And so this is why they are his. He recognized them as his line and his family. You understand what you're saying because of that. But if that's true, then we have a problem with King David being a Jew. His grandmother, great-grandmother, was a Moabite, which is cursed from the beginning. Well, actually, it was 10 generations. 10 generations before Ruth came on the scene from what took place with way back in the beginning. And Joseph, David did not become king until what happened way back in the beginning with Judah. When Judah created incest, 10 generations later, now David is king. Was allowed to be brought back into Israel. Became the main powerful leader. I'm way over time again.
Also, with the theme that you were saying, Josh, that there's a second, and the second, you've also got the first offspring under Abraham is by Hagar, and the second one was the one of promise. Then you turn around and you have the first child of Jacob, Reuben, and he sins, so it bounces again to the second kid.
I got you, but one thing we have to understand what the prophet says. The eternal creator said, Ephraim is my firstborn. Have to look at it through the eyes of the Creator, not through human eyes. Israel was called the what? Firstborn. Why? Through the eyes of the Creator, he is the first. Of all of them, he was the first. And we have God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Why didn't he go Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph? Because he wasn't there. It was supposed to be just those three.
Does it have something to do with Yeshua is the firstborn of many brethren, right?
Right.
So would they, are they reserving that firstborn right to him? And so that's why all the
people always, were? Always. Even when we get to the next chapter of what the prophecy about, a statement that Jacob said about Reuben is a direct relationship to the Messiah. We'll get there when we get there. Not what Reuben did in his life, but him being the first. And something very important that Jacob said. As a firstborn from Jacob. All right. We'll get to there later.
There's some confusion, too, with this firstborn idea. Isn't it more an idea of the preeminent one?
Always. And yeah. That's the same.
It's not one, two, three, four.
No. Yeah. I understand. Because it's the book of the preeminence is the Messiah. Preeminence is the name. Yeshua. Preeminence overall. In a sense, you're true. But we'll get next week, we get into what he said of Reuben to understand a little more of why the firstborn is called the firstborn and who relates to it.